All right, everyone. The Lookout Landing podcast is finally back after a 2 month plus hiatus. Sorry about that. It's episode 14. My guest today is Drew Fairservice from thescore.ca. May I say that? It's always thescore.ca to me.
Score.com. Come on. We are an international group of peoples.
I feel like it used to be thescore.ca, didn't it?
It did, but long story short, it used to be a TV channel, and then the website started to accompany the TV network, and now we are a digital-only company. The TV network was sold in Canada, and we have more American, you know, visitors and people that use the app, which is the big thing, the score.com or the score app on all mobile platforms. That's like the big thing. That's why we are here, and what, you know, where all of the stuff that I do goes, as well as on the web.
Yes, that is the app that I use. I abandoned the old ESPN Score Center quite a while ago because it sucks.
Our bitter rivals. Bitter rivals.
Well, you're dominating. Drew also used to write for Ghost Runner on First, Blue Jays blog that I used to read back in the day, so this is very cool. And then now you're currently contributing to the Score and Getting Blanked and whatever other combination of things they have you doing over there, correct?
I do whatever I have to stay employed.
You do?
Yeah.
Are you, so you're in Toronto, are you in an office or you work from home?
No, we have an office. We have an amazing office here. Just a few blocks. I walk down to the Rogers Center whenever I go, and we have an amazing kind of converted warehouse. We have the entire fourth floor of the building here. There's our kind of blogger content team, like for our feature writers guys, there's eight of us, and then there's maybe like a 15-person editorial team that does kind of news all day long. And then we've got 40 or 50 developers who are working away in code and building apps for building the app for every possible digital. You know, there's an Apple, you know, for iPhone and iPad and Android and even BlackBerry.
Even anyway. BlackBerry. That's yeah. That's dedication, because you know that shit's dying.
They, I don't think. Well. We have a relationship with BlackBerry, I think, is how we'll phrase it to be best.
Hey, I still know people that are BlackBerry or die. They don't want to make the switch, and one of them is my wife, who finally switched over last year. So, Drew, one of the first things I want to talk to you about that I'm always interested in is whenever the Mariners play against Toronto in Seattle, it's just Jays fans like crazy. They come down, they make the trip, and Mariners fans don't even like going to Safeco when the Jays are in town because it is just a bunch of drunk Canadians, and I love it. I love going to the games and just, you know, having beers with these guys that are coming down. What's kind of like the fan level? I mean, is everybody in Canada a Toronto Blue Jays fan? Because I feel like at least some people in British Columbia have to kind of lean more Mariners, but I really don't. I don't know.
I'd say there probably are a lot of people who have maybe dual allegiances. The Blue Jays are broadcast on a national TV platform, mm-hmm. so they're shown from coast to coast, and they have been for years and years and years. So the people in British Columbia, I mean BC, especially, you know, the Lower Mainland or whatever they call it there, where the weather is very temperate compared to the rest of Canada. Baseball's huge there. British Columbia produces so many professional, you know, guys that play in the big leagues. Larry Walker is the one that everyone goes to first. Mm-hmm. Rich Harden, just, you know, millions of guys. Michael Saunders, of course. They all come out of there. So there's a lot of baseball fans there. And then they get to root for the Blue Jays, who they've all grew up kind of being foisted upon us as the national choice. I mean, there are Mariners fans in BC, and there are a lot of Red Sox fans on the east coast of Canada. But they are very much a national kind of Canadian team where everyone gets on board and all roots for the same club.
Let me ask you this. How about Nationals? Is that kind of like a bitter thing? Like, I don't really think anybody in Seattle left as an Oklahoma City Thunder fan. But did anybody kind of in the Montreal area make the switch at least for a while?
I think so. I think they did, because a lot of people, you know, Expos fans especially, would rather die than take on that Toronto team and become part of the English Canada identity. But the Nationals have done such a good job of being total dicks about it and and making it seem as though it was an expansion team that just hatched fully formed in Washington. They were today, the Nationals signed Jamie Carroll, and they're going on about how he was an original National. It's like there was a team before that. They didn't just start the year that they showed up in Washington. It's kind of galling, but I don't think that. Yeah. And to that end, the Nationals have basically spurned any connection to Montreal in their own kind of. They harken back to the Senators' times more than they do the Expos. So
yeah,
there might be a few holdovers, but there are just people. I think people just still like the Expos. There were a couple of days at the Rogers Center this year where they had Expos fan days, where just 3-4 full sections of people showed up in Expos gear.
Awesome. I love that. I love that. I mean, we definitely have a lot of that, you know, still going on in Seattle with the Sonics. Obviously, it's a little more recent for us, but certainly painful, especially when I think the video games is when it gets really painful and you kind of do some of the like historical teams. Mm-hmm. One of the things is like an NBA 2K series or something like that. You can unlock some legends. I haven't seen this. This is what I was told. You can unlock legends and then you have Gary Payton playing in a Thunder jersey. And that was quite upsetting to many people here, which I very much understand.
It's not right. That's not right at all.
It's not right. Okay, so let's talk about, let's get right into this because it's timely and it's topical. And mm-hmm. I've spent the last 2 months not doing anything on the podcast because we've been doing other stuff. The Hall of Fame, I don't want to talk about it too much because we're all kind of sick of it a little bit. But the thing that's interesting to me most is Dan Le Batard selling his vote to Dedsman. Well, selling, donating, or whatever it is. And now he says he regrets it and wouldn't do it. First of all, Dan Le Batard sounds like a very French-Canadian name, does it not?
It does. Maybe there's like the Cajun thing going on there. But it is a French name. I think we could say that.
That's what I thought. And then when I was Wikipedia page, born in New Jersey from Miami, his parents are Cuban.
Hey, you know, whatever works.
What are your kind of thoughts on the whole voting process? And if you, like many of us, you feel like it's broken and we should not be allowing, you know, lifetime memberships to let people vote and maybe removing the cap on 10 people, especially in the next few years. I mean, if you look at next year's ballot, it's just ridiculous. You could choose 15 people. Just like this year, you could probably choose 13 or 14 people that I say in other years would be people that you would select.
I think the biggest issue is just ensuring the integrity of the voting group, which isn't to say that I don't think that Le Batard shouldn't have given his ballot to Dedsman. It's more about these legacy guys and people that don't do it and they vote spitefully. I mean, I just don't think that any of those things are in the best interest of the game. And if you're trying to settle scores or you're just not taking it seriously, it serves no one. The most important thing at the end of the day is like, do the fans benefit? Do the baseball fans that the writers are supposed to be serving, are they doing them a service at all? And by putting these petty votes and deciding that they know when the steroid era started and ended and that they need to, you know, make a show of their vote, and it's all just so self-aggrandizing. That's a real issue. But
yeah,
I don't know that you can really. I mean, it would be really difficult. It won't be too difficult to police in that if you're retired or you know you've moved on from the game. I think most of it is like the writers need to be more honest with themselves and be like, like last year there was a big thing with the three guys who were retired and they started like a golf travel site. And they all still had votes, and it's like just don't send it in, just don't send it in. Yeah. I mean, you're not only are you out of touch, and you're not accountable to anyone. You just if it makes you feel good, I guess I get it, but like you're not doing the people who are the real fans of the game any good. So sure. I just think that's the biggest thing is just ensure that the people who are voting vote well. I mean, you can see it in the difference between the votes that were publicized early on and the votes that weren't publicized, you know, at the end of the day yesterday. There's just too much of a difference between the way that people who are in the game and view the game and also, more importantly, interact with fans on a larger scale than just
sure.
the two or three people at the golf club that these retired guys might run into from time to time.
Of course. I think it's not unreasonable to just say, hey, you shouldn't be able to vote if you're not gainfully employed, if you're not writing about baseball right now, then it's not something that you should be able to make an observation on, because we all tend to get nostalgic and then, you know, think better of the past than it actually was. And I think certainly that's what happened with Jack Morris. You know, everyone that was covering the game in the 80s and 90s, and all of a sudden you see it reaffirmed for you every single time they're going to show that playoff game when he was on the Twins, you know, and going 10 innings and stuff like that. They're going to just remember that he was more than he actually was, because they don't cover the game on an active level anymore. And I think those are probably a lot of the guys that were voting for Morris.
And I think even when it comes to electing the players into the Hall of Fame, there's a 5-year waiting period, you know, to kind of keep the recency bias down a little bit, or whatever the reasoning behind it. I think maybe if you want to apply the same practice to the writers, because the, you know, the famous ones, the Murray Chasses, or the guys who are that much older, they're not watching the guys now. I mean, if you've been retired for 15 years, if you're 80 years old or however old you might be, and you just you were on the beat for 10 years, and then you covered the Olympics for 15 years, and now you've been retired for 5, you don't know anything about the guys any more than anyone else. If anything, you know less, because you were too busy doing other things. I mean, I just think that maybe kind of start to repeal the votes for the guys who, because in a way, someone spends 30 or 40 years covering the game, you don't want to just yank it out of their hands when they retire. But again, once that time starts and that distance increases from the voter to the game, I think at that point, maybe you want to cut the cord a little bit.
Sure. I mean, next year you're looking at guys that are on the ballot where there's people that are going to be voting on the Hall of Fame next year. They probably weren't covering baseball during Randy Johnson's tenure with the Arizona Diamondbacks. I mean, there are people that, like you said, they covered the Olympics for 15 years. Well, that means that they only saw Randy when he was on the Mariners, and they didn't see him when he put together 4 of the best seasons in baseball history back to back to back to back. It's kind of it's a broken system, and I don't know what's going to be done to fix it, or if anything's going to be done to fix it, but it is what it is. It's going to get really, really, really more exposed as we go forward, too, especially with all of these players and the steroid era. And, you know, I think it's just going to take a generation to fix, honestly.
Yeah, I just, my only thing is that you got to get Bonds and Clemens in. That's, as long as that happens.
I think Palmeiro has to get in, too. That's the thing that's crazy to me, is the guy dropped off the ballot. Yeah, I understand everything with Palmeiro, but you got a guy who's got 3,000 hits and 500 home runs. I'm not one for arbitrary milestones, but the career that he put together, pretty ridiculous. And I know that, you know, everybody had an issue with everything he did in court, and it's going to be tough for Barry Bonds to get in because he was a dick, and also he was, you know, the biggest cheater of them all, they say. But I'm with you. In an era where everyone cheated, I don't think you should punish the guys who were the best at cheating.
It is, I don't know. It's, for me, just Palmeiro, if you're a first baseman, you got to be really good. But yeah. I'm having
a hard time. And his rate stats aren't elite, but longevity. Yeah.
I could easily become a very small hall guy. I could do without Biggio, without Reigns, without a lot of the guys that I maybe would have voted for. If someone came to me and said, here's my ballot, it's Clemens, Bonds, Piazza, Maddox, and Thomas, I'd be like, that's fine. That's cool.
Yeah, that's fine. I could do without, Glavin, honestly. Glavin, to me, not a lock.
As long as you are trying to tell the story of baseball as you see it through your eyes, which we are to assume are expert or experienced eyes, I really can't, I don't want to quibble too much with it. Yeah, I don't think Jack Morris belongs in the Hall of Fame, but just a little bit of integrity and a little bit of intellectual honesty is, and a little bit of kind of, again, acknowledging who it is that the Hall is for, who it is you're voting for, and what it means. As long as everyone can kind of have a little bit more integrity and be a bit more honest and just be like, yeah, I'm not really helping anyone with my goofy vote that I hang on to because it gives me something to do for 15 minutes in December when it shows up. Maybe just crumple it up or let them know you're not going to vote anymore, whatever it is. But for me, that serves everybody better.
Sure. A way to eliminate some of the subjectivity from it all. And for me, again, going back to Bonds and Clemens and stuff like that, those games still happened. You know, I don't care if they're in the record books with an asterisk or something. Those games happened, and teams have wins because of them, and teams lost games because of them. And I think the Hall of Fame should be about the people that had the greatest influence on the game one way or another. And It's just so murky, and I'm tired of reading about it and tired of seeing these ballots, and the Murray Chass one really just is so ridiculous for me. And of course, so was the Ken Davidoff one as well. But I don't want to bash, you know, these guys. It's they earned those ballots, and that's fine. And maybe they still don't deserve them. But, you know, it's more a problem with the system than it is with individuals, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. Let's move on from the Hall of Fame, because I think, it's a little ad nauseum on that right now. So, you and I were, let's throw it back to something else. Let's get off baseball for a second. You and I were talking about music on Twitter earlier today. We were talking about Lil' Ass Friends Russ, talking about maybe a little Saves the Day. Tell me a little bit about what did you used to listen to, and what do you listen to now?
I think that my journey through music journey. And whatever is pretty, yeah, a little bit of journey. Started with journey. No, I don't think it's altogether extremely unique. When I was a little kid, my cousin was really into metal, like, you know, hair metal, 80s metal, and that kind of got me into that sort of stuff. And then I got a little bit older and started to kind of do some discovering of bands of my own. And it started with, you know, the NOFX and Pennywise and bands like that, Green Day, as they kind of blew up. And then that took, and then I was one, you know, again, it was back, you know, that was, those were the days where, like, the samplers, the label would put out the cheap sampler and you'd go through it and you're like,
Punk-rama. I mean, come on.
Yeah, exactly. The Punk-rama, Survival of the Fattest, all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And then, so I listened to a lot of that. And then those, you know, I started going to tons of shows, and bands bring other bands on tour, and you start to hear different bands and different sounds, and just kind of progressively went through, started listening to a lot more, just kind of got off of that kind of skate rock train, but still, you know, retaining some of the, you know, not forsaking it, not pretending like it wasn't a big factor, you know what I mean? I'll still, the big thing for me is I look back at records from then, and the stuff that I'll listen to now from then is maybe not, I mean, I'll still listen to a couple of those Lagwagon records. Mm-hmm. I won't really like spin NOFX or anything like that too much, but there's just stuff that you take out of, mostly memories. And then what I'm trying to do now is still find new bands, right? Because it's really easy to just kind of fall back on the stuff I listened to 10 years ago or whatever. So just keep trying to find new bands. But again, got into more hardcore and metal and, like, on along those, down those lines. And, you know, we talked about bands, you know, that bands like As Friends Rust and a lot of that stuff from that era that was fun and it was cool, but a lot of that stuff I won't really go back to very often. As I said about As Friends Rust, they're bands like that, you know, kind of sing-along-y songs, but there's not a lot of staying power to it. So that's maybe good when you're getting back together with the guys, or you got the whole kind of group of friends together and you've had a few and it's late at night and everyone starts to sing and have a good time. But it's not something I'm going to put on at my desk when I'm trying to work or whatever these days. But yeah, just kind of, it's amazing the people you meet, and I've met so many people. I've done so many, like, cool things in my life just based on people I met through going to shows, people met through working in a record store, from hanging out and playing in punk rock bands and going to see terrible bands and terrible, you know, Knights of Columbus style halls in the town I grew up in. And when I grew up outside of Toronto, just coming down into the city to go to bigger shows or smaller shows, whatever, just the same sort of stuff. And you meet people and everyone grows up and you become, you know, adults and fully formed human beings. But that kind of, it's still there, right? It still kind of unites people, and you see people who have punk rock jobs, even though they're in their 30s. And I don't know, it's kind of cool. It's definitely something that absolutely made me who I am today. I could never deny that.
Sure. I have similar, I mean, background to you. I never really grew up, though. I still listen to a lot of that stuff. I definitely grew up NOFX. MXPX was probably my main band growing up. But Pennywise, Full Circle, Straight Ahead, you know, 1995, 1997. Those two albums, that was huge shaping for me. And then that kind of moved into, like, a ska phase, you know, where I was super into Real Big Fish and Skank and Pickle, and then later on stuff like, you know, God, Mad Caddies and stuff like that. All the Fat Wreck.
Oh yeah, those bands. Fat Records had an office here in Toronto. Like, that stuff was huge.
Yeah,
huge here. And again, it's the bands have the the bands you listen to have the bands they listen to, and they try to bring them on tour, and they try to get them, you know, get people to listen to them, and it works. I mean, I remember I went to see,
of course,
I went to see Less Than Jake, probably on the, what was that record called? All My Best Friends Are Metalheads or whatever. It was that era, whatever. After Automatic. Automatic was like the huge record, and then the one that came after that, they were touring, and they brought
Losing Streak.
Yeah, Losing Streak. Story. Yeah. They brought Braid, this band Braid, on tour.
Yeah.
They were like a post-hardcore kind of whatever, post-rock band. And they played, and I was in college, and Braid played, and it was silent. Everyone just kind of sat there and stared at them.
How weird.
And I was blown away. Yeah. I was just like, I bought a shirt. I ordered a record. I needed to have it all. It was just so perfect. It was the right time. I was ready to move on to something else. And that's when, you know, the Get Up Kids 4 Minute Mile was like blowing everybody's mind. And you got a little bit older, and maybe you're not so much into the drunk guy playing the trombone. So you move on to some other stuff. A guy in a sweater who's right. whining about his girl. And then again, you go from there. And the same thing with the kind of harder skate rock bands would bring. They bring hardcore bands on tour, and then, you know, and also the hardcore bands back in those days, everyone played on the same shows too, especially the local shows. So you'd see weird mixes of bands together, and then you're like, yeah. Oh, I like this, and then off you go.
Yeah, I went through that a lot here in Seattle too, especially with the music scene was really blowing up, you know, in the 90s. So a lot of those things, and I definitely a lot of ska and punk rock too. I remember I saw one of my, actually, I think it was the first show I ever went to was MXPX, and they played with the Dingies, who were a ska band in the 90s, and Homegrown.
The worst.
God, getting up to Drive Thru Records. And let me tell you, Drive Thru Records about 2002, that was just it. Everything on Drive Thru Records, I was just 100% in love with. Midtown, mm-hmm. Finch, God, Alistair. Oh, just...
See, I'm a little bit... I think I'm probably a little bit older than you, a couple years older than you.
Yeah, I'm 30.
Okay, so I'm 35.
Mm-hmm.
So that stuff was just a little bit too much. Like, I was... exposed to a few more things. I listened to Lifetime, and as it was Lifetime, and then
of course, well, Jersey's Best Answers. I mean, Jersey's Best Answers, like one of my favorite albums of all time, top 10.
Oh, true.
Sure.
Both those records, Hello Bastards,
yeah, like Hello Bastards is great too.
Yeah. So when all the other bands, like the kind of third wave, so Saves the Day came out, it was like, oh my god, this is perfect. It sounds like Lifetime, but it's, you know, mixed with whatever else. Yeah. They would talk about the Police, and it's like, no, you sound like Lifetime. But all those Drive Thru Records. Excuse me, whatever, the Midtowns and stuff came along.
Yeah.
I was way too cool. Way too cool for that.
Yeah.
No time for any of that. I was like, oh, other than Yellow Card. Yellow Card was like my secret guilty pleasure that I really liked. Yellow Card.
Well, I was super into that scene from about 2003 to 2007. The reason that I'm with the Lookout Landing is because I started writing, and I was an album reviewer, news interviewer, all that with AbsolutePunk.net from 2004 to 2007. And actually, I'm on and off there. I still go back and write reviews every once in a while and do things there as well. So mm-hmm. I was really involved in that, like interviewing Jimmy Eat World and doing reviews for all that. Actually, out of college, I worked at Tooth and Nail Records for a while, did an internship with them. So I was real wrapped up in that whole scene. And I was in the scene, man. I was in the scene. I was into Under Oath.
That's
not nice.
I won't hold that against
you. That's not nice.
It's part of it, right? Like, it all happened, and you know the bands would show up, and sure. I remember, like, I was never into that Tooth and Nail, you know, not many of those bands, and then you'd see these bands would come up and they'd kind of fly under that flag, and it would be like, man, that band is so big for that reason alone. And we would always be like, what about our favorite band? They should be bigger. They should be playing, like, you know, the Matt, what was it, Turning Stone, or what was the name of that festival?
Cornerstone.
Yeah. Oh my god, there'd be like a million people at that thing.
Yeah. I got the Five Iron Frenzy live at Cornerstone record in 1997, I think. Something nice. Like that.
But yeah, I mean, it's, again, it's all, you go to those fests, and I remember I went to Hellfest 2000, the one that when Converge played with the lights on, and that they canceled the Friday night, and like, that was the craziest show. And I went to a few of those, felt like we would drive. Toronto's close enough to just about everything. And so I would go to those bigger fests, but then you could also go to like New York, or you could go to Philly if you wanted to go like a legit hardcore show, and go to Edge Day in Boston and whatever. Like, it was all close enough that it was all accessible. And then bands, all like every band came through as well. That was a good thing. Like, Toronto is big, and there was always a really, really like viable, vibrant scene where people were putting on shows of every kind. You could always go. There was some, again, when I was like 19, you could just go to a show every night, three nights a week. There's some, somebody was playing somewhere, and it was great. And but now I'm old.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, so I don't do the shows anymore. Yeah, it's what it was like in around here too. You know, one night I'd go see Pedro the Lion, and then the next night I'd be at a Yellow Card show with the Juliana Theory and For the Seems Forever, and doing that all through college. Comeback Kid, maybe next day. Yeah, it's Canadian hardcore band for you right there.
Yeah, yeah, the old vocalist from Comeback Kid is around. I see him around sometimes.
Do you? Scott, right? Yeah.
Scott, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Wake the Dead, one of my favorite records. Love that record.
It's a fun record, that's why.
That is a very fun record. So, yeah, looking at where you're at now, I mean, as far as the path, I kind of stayed on the... I still like pop punk, man. I still do. Mm-hmm. I still like it all and have gone through. But I also... I think in college, later in college, I really moved into that kind of death cab and was doing that all, you know, in 2003, 2004. And Iron and Wine and all that kind of stuff. And then moved a little bit and kind of rediscovered, like, all the stuff that I just kind of glossed over. I was listening to, like, Punk-O-Rama CDs. Like, I was too busy listening to Melancholin, so listening to Texas Is the Reason and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kind of, like, rediscovered all that. And now here I am. If you had to pick a favorite record that came out last year, what would it be?
Came out in 2013?
2013, yeah.
I made a little list somewhere. What did I say my favorite record was? The Russian Circles record is probably... I went along a similar kind of path to the, you know, you get on the... You check out the band on the big label, and then as the labels start to get smaller, the bands start to get smaller, you kind of go along and you find... And I did the same thing kind of with hardcore. Again, I got into, like, heavier bands, and those are the bands, the kind of shows that I really liked to go to. So, like, Equal Vision bands and Deathwish bands and Revelation, of course. I had a friend that met a, you know, friend of a friend who was crazy into the early Revelation stuff. So then he and I, my best friend and I, just kind of dove in and started listening to all these bands and whatever. So Russian Circles were a band that I really liked. The bass player was from Botch, from Tacoma.
Yeah, Minus the Bear was the other offshoot of those guys.
Yeah, it's funny. They were talking about Minus the Bear on the Productive Outs podcast.
Love Minus the Bear.
I liked the first few records. I didn't even... The last two
have been so-so.
I didn't even like Planet of Ice that much, to be honest. And live, they're a little underwhelming live. Cause
I totally agree.
I saw them in 2003 at a pretty small venue here in Toronto, and it was cool. And I was really like to see them because that was right when Highly Refined Pirates came out. Mm-hmm. So those are the songs that I liked the best, and it was a nice size venue. But I was blown away because I sat beside them at the bar earlier in the night, and they drank so much before they played. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, there's no way he can drink that much and go play those crazy intricate parts in that on those Minus the Bear records. But yeah, so yeah, Russian Circles is a record that I really liked. I really like Run the Jewels is my favorite record of 2013, actually. The Killer Mike and LP hip hop kind of combination duo thing, amazing. I mean, hip hop was something that was always there. I never really like got into it going to like hip hop shows or anything, but it was always presence. Baptist, I think, is a band from Vancouver or Victoria. That I saw Riley from Productive Outs put Baptists. They're on. Are they on Relapse?
I don't know.
Kurt Ballou from Converge produced their record. It's really pissed off and heavy and in that sort of kind of convergy. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit of Botch. That same sort of stuff. It's great. I picked that up off somebody else's top 10 list, and then I just started streaming it at my desk like every day. When I, you know, around lunch, and it's just an awesome, awesome record. And Lord. Can't get enough.
Cool. Very cool. Yeah, yeah. Riley's been on the podcast before too. Mm-hmm. And me and him kind of around the same time got really into Cloud Kicker. I don't know if you've heard Cloud Kicker.
Yeah, he's like the evangelist for Cloud Kicker.
He's a champion for Cloud Kicker. Yeah. I love those guys. That's definitely in my top 10 records. Well, if you ever want to go back and listen to something that's kind of like skate punk metal-y, my top album is A Wilhelm Scream. They are from upstate New York, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's really kind of like a thrash skate punk.
Yeah.
Super, super, super good. If you want to get some feels from the old days.
Oh yeah,
which I still, you know, I can't avoid it. I can't avoid
I really like the Bronx record from this year, actually.
Yeah,
as well.
Actually, that's one of the albums that I reviewed this year for Absolute Punk. It just missed my list, but that's really good. I love the first record by those guys a lot. The one that has Shitty Future on it.
Yeah,
That's I like the my favorite by them. And I like the mariachi one too. I love the mariachi,
mariachi
record.
Awesome.
It's really
they were cool.
Great.
I saw them once with High on Fire and Buried Inside, and yeah, they have even before that the Shitty Future, that first full length. They have some really cool EPs and 7-inches that are out. The what's the song called? They'll Kill Us All Without Mercy. That's a huge track. I really like the Bronx. They were awesome.
Yeah. Okay. Cool, man. We've talked about enough music. People that aren't into music, maybe I'll just have to put in the description, hey, you can just skip to the 31-minute mark, and then we'll
start. Yeah, you got to put the timing
we'll start talking about baseball again.
It is amazing, though, before we move on, is that on Twitter and whatever, the number of baseball people that, you know, you fly that flag up the pole,
yeah.
You know, that punk rock hardcore, whatever it is, there are just so many people that are reading and writing about baseball right now that all were in that world at some point or
it's
another.
It's really weird. And it seems like it's just baseball, too. It's not like it's just sports. Mm-hmm. I feel like from my experience, it's just people moving into baseball. It's like, yeah, like Riley and Ian Miller and, yeah.
Mark, you know, there's baseball cave-in Twitter. You start talking about cave-in and Mark Normandin from SB Nation. And Bradley Ankrum, who used to do stuff for Bloomberg and Baseball Prospectus, he used to book shows and tours in Florida and stuff. It's amazing. Like, there are a lot of people. I mean, if I didn't know any better, I'd say that white people are really predictable. But you never know. It might not be that.
Let's just do that. Let's just send a little something out. Hey, anybody listen to Hot Water Music in the late 90s? Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Oh, it's everyone who follows you on Twitter. Every single one.
All right. Let's circle it back and let's talk about the Mariners offseason real quick, because I want to get super roster baity here and talk about if there is a possible match for a trade between the Mariners and the Blue Jays. And this has been talked a lot amongst fans, but there are zero rumors for it, and I don't really understand the feeling of the Jays, or are they still in win now mode, or they made all the moves to do win now, but then it fell totally short. Do they give it one more go, or are they ready to kind of like start reloading a little bit? The target that is the perfect fit for the Mariners is Jose Bautista, and I believe 3 years left on his deal at it's about 10 to 12 million a year, I think. I didn't look this up before I did that.
I think he has 2 years and 15 each. 13 or 15 each.
Okay. All right. He's in the back end, back load of that deal. James Paxton, who Toronto originally drafted, and Nick Franklin together, does that get a conversation started for Jose Bautista?
Probably not. They can't. The Blue Jays can't do it. They have to still. They're all in right now. They're paying way too much money to guys like Jose Reyes and Mark Burley for and Ari Dickey as well. Again, like you never know how long Dickey's going to last. I mean, he's what, 39 or 40 this year. I don't think that there's any way they trade Bautista right now. Not for something that isn't going to make them better right away. Which, there's no way you can trade Jose Bautista for anything that's going to make the team better.
Right.
You know, it might make sense. There's so much control of those two guys, but doing
they are,
so.
I mean, they are ready to contribute immediately. Obviously, the question is, what's Paxton going to be? You know, he was really up and down in AAA, and then he just came out and he flat out dominated in his handful of starts in the bigs. He's really tantalizing, but, you know, I think there's definitely a sell high opportunity there as well.
But I just don't think that – I mean, a guy like Nick Franklin might be ideal for the Jays, but there's no way that they can give up on Bautista or Encarnacion without getting, like, a huge return of I would say, guys that are more than big league ready.
Right.
If they trade either of those two guys, because, I mean, Encarnacion has a hilariously friendly deal considering how much he's produced already in the last couple of years, and Bautista's deal looks really good as well. Bautista is a guy who's struggled with injury the last couple of years, but he's awesome. And he's still, I mean, he's not the, you know, elite right-handed power hitter in all of baseball, but he's still very much in the conversation, and
right.
they can't just walk away from that. Again, it's not that Reyes and Burley are bad. It's just that there's so much money invested up front that weakening the team by taking out one of the two or three best players is just something that I cannot see them investigating right now.
Yeah, Batista's injuries have really, like, somehow kept him on this path of, like, being perennially underrated, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he had that huge bust-out season, and then he declined a little bit, and then he's been injured, and he's still so good, and I feel like people don't realize how good he really, really is, even when he's missing, you know, 40% of the year. His numbers are ridiculous.
Yeah, no, he is ridiculous. He is truly ridiculous, and his number, I mean, you look at the year 2010 that he hit 50 home runs, he was even better in a lot of ways the following season. He didn't hit as many home runs, but he walked more, he got on base more because he hit for a higher average. His numbers were in many ways better. I mean, he started out the first half of 2011, you couldn't get him out. Like, those, that was crazy for 2 months.
Yeah,
I mean, even the last 2 years, he's not been quite the same, but you look at his run, his, like, last 4 years, he is as good a power hitter as there is. I mean, he's not... I compared him to Gary Sheffield, I think it was last week, and just kind of maybe said, look at the way that Gary Sheffield's career progressed. They kind of have similar swings, similar approaches. They pull everything. They have, they're really patient. And maybe Gary Sheffield can offer a window into what Bautista's going to age like, even over the next 2 years that the Jays have him under contract. And it is there's no reason to doubt that he's going to fall off. And, you know, there's so much evidence now suggesting that this is who he is. There's no more fluke. Like, he's amazing.
Yeah.
But the Jays are not in a position where they can walk away from that, even for a guy like Paxton and Franklin, who, you know, Franklin can help them at second base immediately. A huge hole, huge problem for them, but I just don't see them doing that.
Yeah, and the Mariners have a ton of second basemen, so it just makes you wonder if it's fit. Yeah, I'm looking at his Baseball Reference page here. My goodness, I did not remember how good that 2011 was. I mean, mm-hmm. how just incredibly absurd was that? Walking more than he struck out to. I mean, just a incredibly low amount of strikeouts for somebody that's hitting 40, 50 home runs a year, walking 132 times in 2011. It's amazing. Star.
Yeah, crazy.
He's a star. Is there a match then? I mean, is there a match? Because the Mariners really kind of have to trade one of Dustin Ackley and Nick Franklin. They don't have to, but I mean, in order to maximize value, and they kind of need to go for it now, Jays need a second baseman. I mean, is there a match somewhere?
Well, I don't know. I mean, what's the back end of the Mariners' rotation look like right now?
They need a pitcher, for sure. I mean, right now it is Felix and Iwakuma, and then it's Taijuan Walker, James Paxton, and Erasmo Ramirez. So it's real young, 3 through 5.
Yeah, that's... Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Again, the Jays aren't even really in a position where they have a lot of, you know... Other than in the low, low minors, they have a lot of really promising young arms. But in terms of guys that can help a team like the Mariners, because the Mariners are in the identical position in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's right? The funniest thing about this, right? Yeah.
So I really struggle to see where the two teams can line up.
I don't know.
To make a deal when they're both in need of the same sort of, like the Jays need, just all I want from them is guys that can pitch 30 times. I don't even care how bad they are. If you're a starter, you can make 30 starts for the Blue Jays. You're in.
Joe Saunders. Go get him.
Yeah, essentially Joe Saunders. I would kill for that as a Blue Jays fan right now, but I can't really see it happening right away.
I think we talk about how similar they are, and I totally get that, but I'm like a more... I think right now, especially because the Mariners have been so bad for so long, I'm in this like completely just like risk-free state of mind where I say... Don't go get, you know, the guy who can give you 30 starts. Get the guy who might give you 15 and might give you 30, and he might be terrible, but he might be awesome. Like, I want that high level of variability, right? I want, like, that's, like, why I'm, if, you know, Tanaka would be wonderful, but if they, you know, I don't expect that to happen. So, Ubaldo Jimenez, there you go. You want to sign a guy that has the potential to just flat out dominate or just be a disaster. That's the guy you go get, because for the Mariners right now, they're like a 76 to 80-win team in True Talent, depending on how their young players do. So you got to get that guy that can be worth like 6 wins, or maybe he's worth nothing. Maybe he's a replacement level pitcher. But it's like you want the hope, right? You got to at least give yourself a chance.
See, if I'm the Mariners, I feel like you have enough volatility in the young guys. You don't know what you're going to get from Walker. You assume he's going to be healthy enough if he's healthy. He's going to be okay, but again, there's still that variability. There's still that volatility in his, just in the fact that he hasn't been through a full season, he hasn't made the, you know, 2 trips around the league or whatever you want to say. And the same thing with Paxton, where you have, because you have the high end, right? You've already got the high end with Felix, and then with Iwakuma to maybe a less heralded extent. I just don't think there's any substitute from there's no substitute for staying out of the bottom half of your depth chart. If you can keep the number 9, number 10, number 11 guys from ever even seeing the mound, I feel like you're so far ahead. And then even, like you said, like that's, to me, the value in a guy like Ubaldo, where, like, yeah, it's really nice to have a good pitcher, but I would, if when you already have Felix and you already have Iwakuma, I would take 3 number 5s. If that's all that Taijuan Walker gives you, again, his 30 starts are going to be better than the 30 starts you get from whoever else you've got to pull off of, you know, the waiver wire to fill in, because then it also just trickles down from there, right? Because you get the guys with the blow up starts and the bullpen's a mess, and then all of a sudden you're in a losing streak instead of taking, you know, 5 mediocre innings and moving on to the next day.
Yeah, I just I get nervous when I think about them playing it safe at this point, because I just don't think it's enough. And I think at this point you have to be really concerned about how Cano is going to age and how much longer he's going to produce at an elite level. And also there's a little bit of a window too. You know, they've only got Iwakuma signed for 2 more years of control, and then Felix is young, but he's got a lot of wear and tear on that arm. So the problem is that the Mariners have kind of a short win now window in a lot of ways, and there's still like 10 more wins of value that needs to be added for them to legitimately say, okay, we're ready to go and make a run at. And they have to do it without Kansas City-ing it, you know?
Yeah, that's when I look at the Mariners roster and I look at, like, there's, oh, it's so disappointing.
Yeah.
I mean, so many draft picks and so many guys that have come through the system, and again, it's too early for, to rule out, sorry, the catcher.
Zunino,
it's too early to rule him out, but I mean, yeah. I love Kyle Seager. I think he's a great, great player.
Yeah, so do we.
But he's like the highest end essentially of the internally developed guys, which is just really a bummer.
It is.
There are so many guys. There are Michael Saunders looks great in the uniform and whatever, has a nice swing, but he just hasn't. At what point do you have to kind of be like, he's not going to be what we need him to be? We have to be more realistic about what he is, and I mean, that even goes with Franklin and Miller and
Ackley and Smoke.
And Ackley,
I mean, it's all there. That's the most frustrating part, is it's like, how long do you wait? Yeah, you're right. They do have a high level of variability, but how much longer can they afford to wait on these guys? And man.
Well, even that, I mean, what are the chances that Smoke wakes up tomorrow and is, you know, the premier switch hitting power hitter first baseman in baseball?
Very small.
It's really, really not likely to happen. If anything, what he gave, you know, through the good parts of last year, that's his ceiling, right? And if you can get that all year, that's amazing. But it's not going to turn into, you know, a guy who puts up 150 OPS plus, or he's not going to, he is what he is. He hasn't ever really hit for power, even when he was minor leaguer.
Yep.
And, I mean, he's a nice player, but you need more. You need,
he's not
need
a nice
to have
player.
More.
He's
not a nice player.
He's a pretty shitty player. Let's be honest.
He's churn. He's a nice guy, I guess, but.
Yeah, he's a good old Southern boy.
But I just feel like you need more. Like, there aren't a lot of impact players. And, I mean, the Blue Jays are the opposite, right? Where last year, look at the Jays, and you get Bautista, who had a really good year, and Encarnacion was amazing. Colby Rasmus had an incredible year. Even Jose Reyes, in the limited time he was on the field, put up good numbers. Brett Laurie is a really valuable contributor. Mm-hmm. But the guys on the Jays team last year that were bad were so unbelievably bad that they took away everything that those guys who performed at like a 4-win level or higher, they took it all back.
Yeah, so Josh Johnson and...
With Josh Johnson, Aaron Sibbia behind the plate. Melky Cabrera was terrible.
Bonifacio.
Crazy thing in his back. Bonifacio, his tourist, whoever they were playing at second base, it was a disaster.
Yeah.
So everything you gain from these stars, you lose with the scrubs. Where you see the team like the Red Sox, and it's like everybody had a really high floor. And I've been using the Red Sox as like this model. And I mean, I even compared them to the Dodgers a little bit today. Well, the Dodgers have stars all around the diamond, but as soon as you get through that right now, there's no insulation. There's no insurance beyond those guys. And
and
I feel like the Mariners are not even there yet. The Mariners they just don't have any real like star. There's nobody who can really produce at a very high level other than Cano.
Yep, that's it.
Among the position players, which is not going to get it done.
But I mean, I think that's part of the argument for Cano is that you had to raise your floor. You're right. You had to raise that absolute baseline. Where now with Robinson Cano, it's like, okay, well the Mariners they're probably not going to win they're probably going to win more than 72 games this year. Now that they've got Cano and they've got they've added probably 5 wins. Because you can't rely on Ackley or Franklin for anything more than replacement level. And while they may reach 3-win players, it's just, it's kind of a pipe dream to do that. So very interesting. And, linked to you did an interview with Cano.
I did. I spoke with him over the summer. And
talk to me about that.
It was great. He's kind of like a... I talk to guys about their approach and the way they approach the game and the way that they do their prep work. And he's kind of not really an old school guy. I mean, he looks at video. He said he looks at video before the game, and he goes in and he does his routine. I mean, he's one of those guys that I think what you'll find with Cano, I don't know if you and some of the Mariners fans who haven't watched him real close, he doesn't take a ton of walks. He took more walks this year than almost any other year in his career. But he'll get on these streaks. He's pretty free swinger, and he can hit anything, and he has power, like pole to pole ability to hit the ball anywhere. But you'll see, but he'll get in a bit of a funk, right? He's like anybody, but then he'll get dialed in a way that he hits everything, and he drives it to the alleys or in Yankee Stadium, hook it over the fence. So you'll see that where he has a real set routine that he does before games and in games, and he doesn't worry too much about those funks that he might fall into, because he knows he's got enough talent and his swing is beautiful. So he'll come out of it in time. So you have to bear with that. You never know. Guy starts out in a new team. He got a huge deal and might squeeze the bat a little bit extra tighter. But he's a great hitter, and everybody around him has nothing but good things to say as well. I mean, I see guys like Jeter. They talk about how he's progressed, and he mentioned it as well. He grew up in that Yankees system where it's just so fertile. I mean, you have so many great players around you at all times to learn from, and he's done that, and he's kind of adds elements to his game. And I think that he's a good enough hitter, and if you look at where he hits the ball and how he hits the ball, he's not some kind of Yankee Stadium mirage, which is probably reassuring to everybody in Seattle.
Sure. Seattle's very friendly. I mean, I think a lot of people, obviously they lazily say, oh, Safeco's such a hard place to hit. It's not a hard place to hit for a left-handed hitter who has real good pull, home run power, and he's going to yank him to kind of that porch, and because Safeco's got a bit of a porch there in right field as well, and it's it's friendly for the alleys too. He's got a lot of room for balls to get down there too, so can't wait to see him hit. It's surreal and it's exciting, and I think the contract is crazy, and like there's no way that it's going to be worth it after four or five years, but who cares right now, who cares, right?
He'll be okay. Even like,
I mean, I think he's shown no signs of decline yet, and he's 31 years old. He's shown no signs of decline. It's encouraging. Everyone's got their time when they're going to start to teeter off, but he seems like he's put it off a lot longer than other people.
He's such a good offensive player that even when the day comes that he's not, contributing at second base, he can move to first. You can be a DH. You can move him to left field. I don't know, whatever. But
right.
I wouldn't worry too much about the whether or not he's going to return value on the contract. He's going to come and he's going to be a really, really superstar caliber player for at least a few years. And then that's the thing with superstars, right? When they decline, they don't instantly become useless. Mm-hmm. He still has to go all the way down through average player and whatever else to before his career is over.
Yeah, and, it's like the Carlos Beltran kind of thing.
Exactly. And I mean, if that one of the knocks on him in New York was that he sometimes he might not like run out ground balls, and he's in the field, he's really smooth, so he doesn't look like he's giving it his all the time.
Yeah.
If he kind of half asses it down the first baseline a couple times, you know, a month or a year, I'm okay with that if I'm a Mariners fan, because if that means that he has, you know, able to keep contributing at a high level for years down the road. So
I mean, he's so durable. He's missed like 7 or 8 games in the last, you know, 5-6 years. The guy mm-hmm. just doesn't miss games, and that's mm-hmm. fine. If he wants to, if there's a couple plays a year where fans want to tear their hair out, and that's fine with me as long as he stays on the field, because that's where the real value is.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to wrap things up with one thing that I like to do on the podcast.
Sure.
And it's a little game I like to play. I like to mm-hmm. do a little trivia with the guests. I'm going to do it for you. You're a lifelong Blue Jays fan, yes?
We could say that. I may tend to like the Giants a bit more now these days, but that's okay.
Okay. All right. What would you say is the year that your level of fandom was the highest with the Jays?
It's weird. When I was a little kid, I loved it, but I was a little kid and didn't know anything. And then 92, 93, I was pretty, you know, obviously they won the World Series back-to-back years, and I was, you know, young enough that I was able to really appreciate it with, you know, earnestly and kind of lose myself in it. So I'd say either 92 and 93, or then even like probably 2008 when I first started writing about the Jays just for fun, and it really made it a lot of fun to watch and follow, because it's kind of added to my enjoyment of the game.
Sure. All right. Here's your trivia.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
You got to name the 1993 Blue Jays roster, as many as you can.
Okay.
Can you do it?
All right.
Ooh, this is... The lineup's going to be easier in the rotation, I'll tell you that right now.
Okay, so you got... We'll start with the lineup. Mm-hmm. So, like, did you have the most common lineup, or what are you after for it here?
I'm on the Baseball Reference team page right now. So, okay. I mean, if you want to say someone like Luis Sohu, who had played 19 games, that's fine. That's mm-hmm. fine. Anybody that you can remember that was on that roster at some point of that year.
All right, well, so we can go with WAMCO. We got Devon White, Roberto Alomar, Paul Molitor, Joe Carter, John Olerud, and then you had Ricky Henderson played some left field, of course.
Yep.
Tony Fernandez.
Yep.
Pat Boers behind the plate.
Very good. You've named the entire, that's 8 of 9. You're missing a third baseman.
Well, there was Ed Sprague, and correct. There would be Kelly Gruber.
And Gruber.
He probably was hurt a lot in 93. He played 92. He was famous. He had the chop in 92. No Gruber 93, really?
No Gruber 93.
All right. Then on the mound, there was Dave Stewart, and there was terrible Jack Morris, and there was Juan Guzman, and Jimmy Key. Not Jimmy Key. And Al Leiter.
Yes.
And
Swingman.
Dwayne Ward in the bullpen. David Wells in the bullpen?
No David Wells.
Ah, oh, too early. Oh, okay. And who else was back there? I'm struggling. Who was the lefty in the bullpen? I can't remember. This is embarrassing.
This is not embarrassing. This is a hell of a show. I'm very impressed.
This is 20 years ago. My God.
Yeah, this is impressive. This is the baseball card era heyday right now for me.
Who else is in the pen?
Yeah.
Danny Cox?
No. Yes, Danny Cox. There it is.
Danny Cox. He had a beastly mustache. I can't think of too many others.
Wow.
David Cohn.
No David Cohn.
He definitely played for the Blue Jays. It must have been later. I can't remember.
Yeah. You want to know what you've missed? It's not many.
Okay.
And out of the pen, you got Mike Timlin.
Oh, of course. Of course. That's amazing.
And the lefty out of the pen is Tony Castillo.
All right. I'll forgive myself that one.
Okay. And then in the starting rotation, we had Todd Stottlemyre.
Yeah, that's embarrassing, too.
And did you say Pat Henkin?
I did say Pat Henkin, of course.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure. Also out of the pen, we had Woody Williams.
Yeah, that's I'll forgive myself that one
Those
too.
are very, very healthy team. I mean, that's pretty much it. We're talking about 12 pitchers of any significance that pitched during the year.
Morris was so bad that year, and he was hurt, and he didn't play in the in the playoffs at all. He barely pitched after September. I looked at this yesterday. That's how I know that about him.
Yeah.
But then they
Man.
bought him out.
And then off the bench, we have Darnell Coles,
Yeah.
Turner Ward,
All right.
right fielder Darren Jackson.
Oh yeah.
How about Dick Schofield?
Yeah, I thought Dick Schofield might have been 92, but that was Alfredo Griffin in 92,
Yep, and then
the backup shortstop.
backup catcher Randy Knorr.
Yeah, he's the bench coach in Washington, actually, right now, the
Yep.
Nationals, yeah.
Yep, that's it. And then as minor pieces of trivia, we also had Sean Green with 6 plate appearances and Carlos Delgado with 2 plate appearances.
As a catcher, he was a catcher. They
Yep.
forced him behind the plate back in the day.
Yep. He went 0 for 0 for 1 with a walk.
Of course.
So there you
Can't wouldn't be a Carlos Delgado game without a walk.
go. That's right. That was very impressive, I gotta say. And sometimes I do this with when we get a couple people on, and we all just pick a team at random, and we'll get if there's 3 of us, we'll get one guy will be the moderator, and we'll go back and forth, and the first guy to miss is the one who loses. And you would have dominated on the Jays. I mean,
Well, they won.
we put one right in your wheelhouse, but still,
Yeah.
that's impressive.
They won the World Series, so it was kind of a big deal.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
Maybe I should have hit you with a 98 or gone back and done like an
Oof.
86 or something.
I'd struggled 98. I was in the woods for a while when I was going to shows and hanging out and being too cool for everything. It wasn't a non-presence in my life, but it wasn't the same that it was after
Right.
I lived in Asia for a year, and then when I was away in Asia, I got to appreciate baseball a lot more because it wasn't there. It was like an everyday thing.
Right.
So when I came back, that's when my baseball fandom really like hit its stride, I think.
Yeah. Ooh, 98. 98's got some tough one. How about Craig Gerbrek?
Craig Graybeck, oh yeah. Is
Graybeck,
that
yes.
Orlando Merced on that team?
No.
90, was 98 the year they were good? Is that the year with Jose Canseco?
98, they were 88 and
Yeah,
74.
88 was the year that they were good. That's
Canseco.
it. Yeah,
Yep.
Canseco hit like a million home runs, and Brad Fulmer, and I'm trying to think who else.
Jose Cruz Jr.
Jose Cruz Jr. That was the. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And then they were offered. That's the famous trade rumor that they were. Jose Cruz Jr. was really good that then. They got him from Seattle, did they not?
Yes, they did for Timlin and Paul Spolgerik, I believe.
Right.
Yep.
And then they were offered David Wright for
Really?
Jose Cruz Jr. And they said no because he was in like low A or yeah, he was in the Sally. He was in the South
Yeah.
Atlantic. And they said JP Ricciardi famously said, "I'm not trading Jose Cruz for some kid in the Sally League," and it was David Wright.
Man, Jose Cruz, that what kind of a busted career. I mean, he was a solid player, had some solid years, but for everything that surrounded him and how much Seattle fans still lament the loss of him, because I mean, he was really, really great. I mean, that was his peak. He was almost never better than he was as a 23-year-old rookie in Seattle.
Yeah, he went away real fast. So I guess it just kind of got figured out again a little bit. He didn't hit some home runs, but
Yep, had some injuries too. Late in the career, kind of fell apart after he turned 30. Happens to the best of us.
It sure does.
Happened to you, it's happening to me soon, right? No.
Exactly.
All right, man. Thanks, Drew, for everything, and appreciate you coming on. And who knows? Maybe the Mariners and the Jays will match up with the trade as two teams in a similar situation, but it's probably a pipe dream.
Here's hoping, and I would like to just now apologize for all of the people from British Columbia who attack Safeco Field every time that the Jays come to town.
Oh, it's amazing. Last year there was a guy, and I went down with a few buddies of mine, and he could not stop singing "Call Me Maybe," and he had a huge beard, and he was wearing jorts that went about mid-thigh where you could see the pockets. Yeah, really nice.
British Columbia, I take no responsibility for the actions of anyone born out there. It's weird. It's a different place.
I was just in British Columbia last week, actually. My wife and I, we went up to Vancouver for a couple days. We like it up there. It's a nice spot.
I have only been to Vancouver once, and I did not especially enjoy myself.
Well, I need to get out to Toronto because I've heard, you know, Toronto. It's a spot.
You should. Center of the universe, baby.
I should. And in the meantime, I'll just wait for Big Brother Canada to start. Oh God.
You see ads for that? Is that why you said that?
No, I probably shouldn't say this, that people know it, but I like Big Brother. My wife and I, we like Big Brother, and we like Big Brother enough that when we heard there was Big Brother Canada, I went and made sure I pirated the entire season and we watched the whole season.
Your accent must be on point then.
Yeah, man. Some of those guys from Northeast Canada, they really landed on. Newfoundland guys.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. They are a breed unto themselves. Good people, though. I tell you, good people.
Yeah. All right, my man. Have a good one and appreciate it again.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care.